Thank you very much, and my thanks to the organizers for the invitation to give this talk and for giving me the opportunity to participate in this interesting workshop. I have to confess that I don't do much multivariable operator theory, but I decided to talk about the stuff that I'm doing, which I think is closest to the subject. So I hope that you may find some of the things I'm saying of some interest to you. And I mean, there obviously some of the work that is done currently on multivariable theory extends possibly to the infinite variable situation. Okay, so I said too much in the abstract. I decided to restrict myself to speak about two things. So the first part of the talk will be about recent work, joint work. Well, there are many authors here. Andreas Defant, Leonard Frerik, Joachim Ortega-Sella, and Miriam Unai. It's a preprint which is out on the archive, which is about a certain inequality for homogeneous polynomials going back to Bornblust and Hiller in the early 1930s. And in the second part of the talk, I will say something about boundary limit functions of elements in Hardy spaces of Dirichlet's series. And that is based on joint work with Eero Saxbo. Okay, so what is the Bornblust Hill inequality? Well, it's a statement about an M homogeneous polynomial in N complex variables. So I use standard notation for this. Here is our M homogeneous polynomial in N complex variables. And let's note a trivial fact. If you take the square sum of the coefficients, the L2 norm of the coefficients, then obviously this is bounded by the L infinity norm, the H infinity norm of the polynomial on the polydisk. Now, we ask the following question. That's not how Bornblust and Hiller did it, but anyway, that's how we ask it. Is it possible to have a similar inequality, taking now instead the LP norm of the coefficients for some p less than 2? And now I want a constant C here, which does not depend on the number of variables. So I want C to depend on M, but not on N, the number of variables. And since I asked the question, of course, you understand that the answer is yes, it is possible. And that's the theorem of, or the inequality of Bornblust and Hiller. It says, yes, you can do that. And the best P you can get is 2m over m plus 1. Well, this is not so easy to prove, and I will not try to prove it, but once you know this is a fact, you will be interested in knowing the asymptotic behavior of this constant C when M grows. So that's what we will be after. So let me mention, well, it's actually where it all started, with an inequality of Littlewood from 1913, which is the following. It's a multilinear inequality, or a bilinear inequality. So we have a bilinear form on Cn cross Cn. And Littlewood proves that the 4 over 3 norm of the coefficients of this form, Ei is here the canonical base in Cn, so these are the coefficients of the form. The 4 over 3 norm is bounded by, well, this constant square root of 2 times the sup of the form when vectors run through the polydisk, Dn. And also, I should say again, the 4 over 3 is best possible. You cannot have a constant here independent of n for any p less than 4 over 3. So 4 over 3 now, as you see, is 2m over m plus 1. And it was extended, the inequality of Littlewood by Bonnblust and Hiller, to m linear forms. So now the 2m over m plus 1 norm of the coefficients is bounded by square root of 2 to the m minus 1 times the supremum of the norm over the dn, m copies of dn. And again, 2m over m plus 1 is best possible. Now, we come to the theorem that we proved in this paper. It says that we have the same kind of inequality for homogeneous polynomials with a constant here which is almost the same except this thing in front. And this is the new thing here is what we call hypercontractivity, by which I mean that the constant here depends exponentially on m. What has been known since the work of Bonnblust and Hiller was that the inequality holds with constant m raised to the power m over 2, modulo factor of exponential growth. So hypercontractivity, the polynomial Bonnblust-Hiller inequality is hypercontractive. That's the statement. That's the what this theorem says. So I will explain briefly how to get to this result. And since I mentioned multilinear forms, you understand that one has to make use of multilinear forms to prove the result. And indeed, there is a one-to-one correspondence between symmetric multilinear forms and homogeneous polynomials. So I gave you this definition of a symmetric M linear form. If I take any coefficient here, then if I make a permutation of the index set involved here, then I get this, I have the same, the coefficient will be the same. So having said this, well, if we restrict a symmetric or any multilinear form to the diagonal, of course we get a homogeneous polynomial. And to go in the other direction, to get from the polynomial to the form, we do it as follows. We write the polynomial in this way, prepare for a transition to the form by writing it by demanding to have this specific order of the elements of Z. Once we have done that, we simply demand to have the corresponding symmetric multilinear form with precisely these coefficients at these indices, and we divide them by the number of indices that can be obtained from this by permutation. Okay, so that's how we do it, and if you just think about it, you will realize that the number of permutations is bounded by m factorial, which happens if all the indices here are different. There is a lemma by Harris which says that we have this inequality between the supremum of the form and the soot norm of the polynomial, with again a constant here which depends exponentially on m. I mean, you can see that this is bounded by e to the m. Now, this is how to go from the form to the polynomial, but it's not what we need to prove the theorem, because if you just now start from here and use the multilinear von und Bluestein inequality, then this thing here will be bounded by what I have I've written here. I just use the fact from the previous slide that the coefficients look like this. So we have this the number of permutations in the denominator, and this comes out in the inequality like this, which is basically 1 over m factorial square root. And when you move this to the other side, you unfortunately get the m to the m over 2. So you have to do something more if you want to do make the improvement. So in this way, you get the result by von und Bluestein Hilleux. So the ingredients for the proof have been around for some time. First is a wonderful inequality by Bly, Ron Bly, from 1979, which gives an estimate for the, well, 2m over m plus 1 norm of the coefficients of the of any multilinear form. So on the right hand side here, what you do is that you freeze one of the indices, and you take the L2 norm, you take the square root of the L2 norm, and you sum up over all possible values for this specific index that was frozen, and then you do this for all k's, take the 1 over m root and multiply together. So this is one piece, and the other piece is a wonderful inequality of Bayard, which is sort of a substitute for the Kinchin inequality, and it's actually a rather elementary inequality. You can get it from the one variable result, which says that the Bergmann space norm on the disk is bounded by the H1 norm on the disk. So it's basically an extension of that simple inequality. Okay, so armed with Harris, Bly, and Bayard, one can run the proof, and I've written down the proof, but I don't think I will go through it. I just mentioned that, okay, we start out estimating in the natural way, and then in the first step, we may apply Bly, and then we make, and then we freeze, according to what Bly did, we freeze one of the variables, and we arrive at a new polynomial of one degree less, one less than the original polynomial, and we apply Bayard, and then afterwards we make a summation which enables us to use Harris's lemma, and then we arrive at the inequality. So it's really rather straightforward. All the pieces were there. It's a matter of putting them together in the right way. Arguing in this way, the constant I get is not exactly the one I wanted, but one can make a refinement. Okay, so that's the von und Bluestein inequality. It is hypercontractive. That's the result. Okay, so what's the consequences of this? It may seem marginal, but actually you get a number of interesting consequences. And let me explain some of them to you. The first is a statement about so-called Sidon sets. So here's a definition of a Sidon set. We don't need... what I'm interested in is Sidon's constant for homogeneous polynomials. So I'm after the best constant I can put here. I have a homogeneous polynomial. Again, I just take the absolute values of the coefficients and I ask for the best constant I can have here. Having the Bonne-Bloisselle inequality, that's just a question of applying Hölder's inequality, of course. All you have to do is to compute the number of different monomials of degree m in n variables, and this is this binomial coefficient, n plus m minus 1 over m. So you, applying Hölder's inequality, you get this for the Sidon constant. Actually, you will see that this is only of any use if n is large, because you can also use the simple estimate that you get from the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. So it's only when n is so large that the minus 1 over 2m does anything good for you. That's when you have that, when this is useful, and that is when log n is larger than m. Okay, so you get this, and what can you use this for? Well, you can use it to solve a problem that was raised by Boas and Hobinson in 97. They were interested in studying the Bohr radius on the polydisk, and by that I mean the following. I define Kn, the Bohr radius, to be the largest positive r, such that for all polynomials we have an inequality like this. So I put I put absolute values in the summation. I look at z in a polydisk scaled by the number r, and I want to have constant 1 in this inequality. So the sum of the terms should be bounded by the supremum norm of the polynomial. When n is equal to 1, this is the classical Bohr radius, which was studied by Bohr himself. And I don't know exactly who did what at which time, but it's common to attribute this to these three people: M. Ries, I. Schur, and F. Wiener. When n is larger than 1, the precise value of kn is unknown. And then, of course, we're interested in knowing the asymptotic behavior of k. Well, let me give you a footnote. Who's F. Wiener? It's sort of interesting. I should have had a picture, but I'm not sure if a picture is available, actually. When Boas and Hobinson wrote their paper, they saw the names. It was, you know, it was Ries, it was Schur, and so on. And of course, they assumed that this was the famous Norbert Wiener. So that's what they wrote in the paper. Mm-hmm. But then they discovered, I think it was Larry Salzman who made them aware of the fact that this is not a Norbert Wiener. And then they wrote a nice biography on the real Wiener for this problem, which is this person, Friedrich Wilhelm Wiener, born in 1884. One does not know the circumstances around his death, but it seems probable that he was a casualty of World War I, so he died at a young age. Anyway, you can read this on the archive if you want. So back to the asymptotic behavior of Kn. So what Boas and Hobinson did was to make this bound. They found this bound for the Bohr radius in the polydisk, and later this was improved to the following by Defont and Frerik. And now, using this result we have for the Sidon's constant, we get the right asymptotic behavior, well, apart from the constant, of Kn. So it's square root of log n over n. Well, I will not prove it, but I will just briefly explain how to prove it. So now you expand your polynomial into homogeneous polynomials. You assume the norm is less than 1. And then you use a wonderful lemma. The lemma is well known, and due to F. Wiener, which says that the infinity norm of each of the homogeneous polynomials is bounded by 1 minus the square of the first coefficient of the polynomial, the constant of the polynomial, constant coefficient. And armed with this, it's actually now a pretty easy to do the proof. You just do the obvious estimate, and you use the estimate for the Sydow constant in the right way. I won't go through it, and you shouldn't try to read it, but anyway, that's how it looks. Okay. So, of course, if you want to do more here, you can do it, or try to do it, because we make life easy for ourselves by scaling with the same R in each variable, right? You can ask the same question without any such democratic treatment of the variables. Simply, what is the set of the subset of the polydisk such that you have an inequality like this? That's a more difficult problem. Of course, that makes it less easier to use the expansion into homogeneous polynomials. Okay, so now we come to another thing, which is how one, it's actually the original motivation for the work of Bonnenblüstein and Hille. They wanted to solve a problem that had been around for a while in about the Euclid series. So series of this type, a n n to the minus s, summed over the positive integers. And the problem I wanted to solve was a statement about the relation between the various abscissa of convergence for such a series. So and when you have a Fourier series, a Dirichlet series, you have at least, well, you have more, but you can define three abscissa of convergence. You have the half plane in which the series converges conditionally, the half plane in which it converges uniformly, and the half plane in which it converges absolutely. And these half planes are in general not the same. And well, so I call these numbers C, B, A. C conditional, B uniform, A absolute. And it is, of course, easy to see that A minus C lies between 0 and 1, and in fact you can get any number in between. The most interesting quantity is the difference A minus U, absolute minus uniform. And Bohr himself proved that it cannot exceed 1 over 2, but he couldn't even exhibit one example of anything such that A minus U is positive. And then with the paper of Bonnenblüstein and Hille in 1931, the problem was completely solved. A minus U is 1 over 2. So I want to discuss a little around this theorem that emerged from the work of Bonnenblüstein and Hille. And to do that, I will switch to another abscissa of convergence, which is what was called the abscissa of boundedness and regularity. So that's the infimum of those sigma naughts such that the function is represented by the Dirichlet series is analytic and bounded in the half plane. So so what Bohr proved was that the abscissa of uniform convergence is the same as the abscissa of boundedness and regularity. So it means that we can instead look at bounded analytic functions represented by the Dirichlet series and look at the abscissa of absolute convergence for such functions. So for that reason, I now introduce the space which I will call curly H infinity, which consists of those bounded analytic functions f in the right half plane, such that f can be represented by an ordinary Dirichlet series in some half plane. And with this definition, we can rephrase the theorem of Bonnenbluth and Hiller as follows. The infimum of those C, such that, that an inequality of this form holds for every function in curly H infinity, equals 1/2. Now it turns out that one can actually get a better inequality, which says that instead of taking n to the minus c, one can take n to the minus 1/2 and look at it on a finer scale. Namely, we get an exponential factor here with this, well, square root of log n, log n in the exponent. And we can find, we can determine the supremum of those c's such that this inequality holds, and this number is equal to 1 over square root of 2. Well, this is in fact a theorem of these three people, Balasubramanian, well, Kalalu and Kefalek from 2006. But the point here is that you can now in fact nail down this supremum of C by using the hypercontractive Bonnenbluth-Hill inequality. So, yeah. So in order to see the relation between this and the Bonnenbluth-Hill inequality, one should do what Bohr did, namely to relate a formal power series in infinitely many variables to the your Dirichlet series. And this you do by factor each integer into prime factors. Well, in the usual way, and then associate with each such factorization a point in the infinite polydisk, like this. Okay, and then you can write your Dirichlet series as a formal power series in infinitely many variables. And now, of course, the thing is that this is not just a formal correspondence. Your space curly H infinity is in fact isometric to H infinity on the polydisk or on the infinite torus, depending on how you define things. You can either define it as L infinity intersected with H2 on T infinity, or you can in fact define it as a space of bounded analytic functions on this part of the polydisk. Either works. And this works thanks to a classical result of Kronecker on Diophantine approximation. Okay, so we have this relation. The Bohr correspondence, I will refer to it, between Dirichlet series and functions on the infinite torus or infinite polydisk. And it's when you want to prove something about Dirichlet series, it's really a quite indispensable tool. And this question about absolute convergence is really an interesting example. But there is one thing here which I would like to mention, and that is that it's not immediate. You cannot just apply directly the Bonnenbluth-Hill inequality as we did before with the Bohr radius, because now we don't treat the different variables in the same democratic way, because we have different radii for the different variables. So the problem becomes more difficult. The expansion into homogeneous polynomials does not apply in the same immediate way. And to get results, one has to apply other methods. And I will show you now a wonderful result. Which combines the Bonnenbluth-Hill inequality with probabilistic methods and methods from analytic number theory. So it's again a Seddon constant, if you like, a statement about a Seddon constant. So now we are looking at just polynomials, Dirichlet polynomials, finite Dirichlet series. Let's call such a such an object Q, Q of S. So then we look at the soup of such an object on the imaginary axis, and we take the L1 norm of the coefficients, and again we compare, and we want to have the best constant C here. So you take here, you have the L1 norm, here you have the L infinity norm on the imaginary axis. So what's the best constant you can have? Well, if you just apply Cauchy-Schwarz, you get square root of n. But in fact, the right additional factor to put here is something which looks like this: exponential to the power minus 1 over square root of 2 plus little o of 1 square root of log n log log n when n tends to infinity. I think it's fair to contribute this result to Konjagin and Kefalek. What they got was the same, but with not with precise constant here. So they got the bound from above and below. And then later, De La Bretèche in 2002 estimated from one side, and armed with this hypercontractive version of the Bonoblue-Tillian inequality, all we have to do is just at one point in the proof plug it in, and you get the sharp result. But the ideas in the proof really should be they belong to Konjagin and Kefalek. So, well, this is who did what. The estimate from above, from below is due to De La Bretèche, and he also showed he cared about constants, so he got this from the method of Konjagin and Kefalek. Okay. So let me now say a few more things about the function theory of this interesting space curly H infinity, which is sort of the restriction to the half plane of infinite dimensional H infinity on the infinite dimensional polydisk. So again, now for the things I will be discussing, you still need the Bohr correspondence, but we will now leave Bonoblue-Tillian inequality. Okay. So now, the first result I would like to start with is the following, which is just a computation. You have a bounded a Dirichlet series, which is bounded in the right half plane. Then the series converges uniformly, and then you can just integrate the series. And when you integrate the series, what falls out will be an inequality like this. So it's just a computation. Talking about famous mathematicians, this is not. I'm not writing it in the wrong way. We submitted this paper to a journal. Well, you saw the journal on the first page, and there was a very knowledgeable, probably editorial assistant who saw this, Carlson, and decided to correct it to Carlson. I mean, I usually don't read Gallup proofs as general, but actually this I managed to capture. I'm happy I did that. So another Swedish mathematician, and I think he did this in the 20s. So we have an inequality like this. The square sum of the coefficients is bounded by the L infinity norm. And in fact, if referring to what I discussed before, using Cauchy-Schwarz, you actually get Bohr's inequality A minus U less than or equal to 1 over 2. Okay. So this is Carlson's theorem, and then a more fancy way to think of Carlson's theorem. Now I just computed directly with the Dirichlet series. We can also use the ergodic theorem or think in terms of ergodicity to obtain this thing, which is a useful thing to do. So we may think of the any vertical line in the half plane as what we can call a quasi periodic motion. That is for each prime. We associate the periodic motion on the circle of radius p to the minus sigma naught. And so vertical translations we can think of as a motion on a system of circles or an infinite dimensional torus. And if we do that and we use the product measure of normalized arc length measure for the circles, then it is clear that again using this approximation theorem of Kronecker, that the flow is ergodic, and we may use the ergodic theorem. So you get the fancier proof of this simple-minded result of Carlson's theorem. Okay, so an interesting question now is what happens when you go to the boundary? Is Carlson's theorem preserved? And I will answer that question. It was first raised by Hedenmo. But before I do that, I will mention a few other things to place this in context. So I will mention another space, which is the H2 space in this context. You simply take Dirichlet series for which the coefficients are square summable, call it curly H2, and then you observe that these guys, by Cauchy-Schwarz, will be analytic in this half plane, in a smaller half plane, C plus 1 over 2. So you shift one half to the right compared to what we could do before. And then it's quite clear that via the Bohr correspondence, this is actually a restriction of H2 on the polydisk to this half plane. And you see that H infinity is contained in H2, as you would expect. And in fact, we have the result that you probably would expect to have, the relation between H infinity and H2, namely that H infinity is the multiplier, constitute the multipliers for H2, and with the right, the norm of the multiplier is the supernorm of the Dirichlet series in the half plane. This is a result which we did in 97. Okay, so anyway, for H2, it's a space of analytic functions. It has a reproducing kernel, and the reproducing kernel is the Riemann zeta function. In this way, zeta s plus w bar. So then, since the reproducing kernel looks like this, you can actually you can do this in other ways, but anyway, you see that the estimate, the pointwise estimate you get for the growth of functions when they approach the line sigma equals 1/2 is this, and this is the same estimate that governs the growth of functions in H2 of the corresponding half plane. So it's rather natural to ask if there is a more precise link to that space. And this is indeed so. And this is a mean value inequality, which people in analytic number theory know, which also can be proved in a rather elementary way. So if you fix the length of some, you fix a t and take any y and integrate over an interval of length t, then you get an inequality like this. Of course, I'm assuming that I have a boundary value, but it is implicit in this estimate that you have a boundary value because you have a function in H2. So you can, in fact, extend it to the line. So actually, locally, functions are in H2, or if you really want, insist on being precise, f of s over s, say, belongs to H2. Okay, so having said this, what about Carlson's theorem? The first thing I would like to say is that if you look at functions in H2, then you get this immediately. So what am I saying now? I'm saying that you have Carlson's theorem also for functions in H2, wherever functions are bounded, which they are to the right of sigma equals 1/2. And this you can extend to the boundary, C simply because it holds for polynomials, and by the inequality I had on the previous slide, since polynomials are dense, it extends. So on the, you also have this on the boundary. But on for the for H infinity, Carlson theorem does not hold, and things can go as bad as you want. The limit doesn't have to, here doesn't have to exist, and even if it exists, which it does, if the function is a singular in the function, well, then the modulus is 1 on the boundary. Still, you can get this L2 norm on the boundary as small as you wish. So it goes wrong in any way you can imagine. And this is a bit weird, perhaps, that it is okay for H2, but it goes wrong for H infinity. Anyway, the proof is based on a very beautiful construction of Rudin. If you ever read his book, Function Theory in Politics, you find it there. It's a wonderful construction. Rudin proves that if psi is a positive, bounded, and lower semi-continuous function on the distinguished boundary of the polyd disk, dm, then psi is almost everywhere the radial boundary limit of the modulus of a function h infinity in dm. A highly non-trivial result, I would say. And, well, armed with this, well, in fact, you can do it in two variables, which means that you only look at two to the minus s and 3 to the minus s involved in your Dirichlet series. And what you do is that you consider the imaginary axis now as a subset of T2, and you cover it by an open set of a small measure as you wish. And you take as psi in Rudin's construction a function being 1 on this set and epsilon outside the set. So now the problem is that the set that we are interested in, which is the imaginary axis, viewed as a subset of the torus, has measure 0. Right? So it's not immediately applicable. So you have to go into the construction, and it turns out that you can modify the construction, Rudin's construction, so that you get what you're after. But it's really Rudin's construction that gives this. Okay, so having talked about H2, H infinity, it's quite natural also to ask, what about HP? And this is a question that was asked by Bayar and discussed by Bayar in a paper in 2002. And Bayar noticed that there are two ways in which we can define curly HP. By the ergodic theorem, we can choose whether we want to do it via polydisks. Okay, take F a polynomial. Let M sub M infinity be the Haar measure on the distinguished on T infinity. And then use the usual Hardy space norm for the polynomial. And then we can take the closure of polynomials. Alternatively, we can look at Dirichlet polynomials, integrate along the imaginary axis, which goes very well. And then we can take the closure of polynomials with respect to this form. So that's the way to define H, curly HP. There is a paper by Cole and Gamelin back to 1986 where they discuss properties of infinite dimensional analytic functions, and from in that paper one finds an estimate like this. So functions in HP behave when you approach the boundary sigma equals 1/2 as functions in HP of this half plane, and so it's rather natural to ask if you have the same embedding for functions in HP. So say for every Dirichlet polynomial, not to run into trouble about boundary values. So do we have an inequality like this for every Dirichlet polynomial? It is immediate, well, we have it for 2, and then by just taking powers of f, you get it for all positive even numbers. But for the remaining p's, this is a very difficult problem. Let me mention one thing, since the Ferguson-Lacy weak factorization theorem was mentioned the other day. that if you manage to extend that weak factorization theorem to infinitely many variables, which probably is out of reach, but anyway, if you manage to do that, then this would follow for p equals 1. And this is a problem that has been discussed by Helsen. Of course, you can ask for less, but still it seems hopeless, at least for me. I mean, you can have a smaller q on the left-hand side and see if you can do this. Still, it seems quite difficult. Okay, this is a terrible slide, so you shouldn't take a look at it. You should just ignore it, basically, and just I will explain what it says. So when you go to the boundary in the half plane, say in H infinity, you have boundary limits, right? Viewed as a one-dimensional function. What is the connection between this and the function on the infinite polydisk? Right? And this terrible slide gives an answer to that question. Yes, when you approach the imaginary axis, you take all the possible boundary limits you can get. You shift the Dirichlet series, so you look at all possible Dirichlet series that you get by choosing different points in the polydisk. That gives you a set of values on the torus, and in fact, this is the right boundary value of the function. So you have a Fatou theorem in the way you would like to have a Fatou theorem, and it is actually a consequence of the good old Fatou theorem and the ergodic theorem. So it's a combination of those two things which give you a nice Fatou theorem. So it means it's meaningful to talk about, to relate the boundary values on a vertical line with the function on the torus. And the next slide is the same for p larger than 2. We can do the same thing. So the whole point here of that I'm mentioning these results is that there is a very curious thing here, which I don't understand at all, which says that if you now relate this embedding problem to the ergodic theorem, then you will see that, and using the Fatou theorem that I had on the previous slide, if f is in HP and the embedding holds, then the ergodic, we have what you could call strong ergodicity on the boundary, which means that for every tau on the corresponding polydisk, we have an equality like this. I mean, the ergodic theorem says that for almost every tau we have it, but now having the embedding, it actually holds for every tau. So we have the same thing as you would have for a continuous function. So you can also go in the other direction and see that by the closed graph theorem, it's actually equivalent to having such a strong ergodic theorem. So the curious thing now is that our strong variant of the Birkhoff-Kinchin ergodic theorem for functions in HP is known to hold only when p is 2, 4, 6, and so on. It's rather puzzling, I think. I thought I could close by mentioning something about, well, an operator. Okay? So, Ries projection on T infinity. Okay? It's not bounded for any other p than 2, because in one dimension the constant is larger than 1 when p is different from 2. So when you take infinitely many of them, they multiply and you get infinity. And of course, you may also note that had this been true, I could solve the embedding problem, because I could just interpolate in the usual way. Okay, so but what is true for Ries projection on the infinite torus? Well, it is true that it is bounded from L infinity to L2, right? That is obvious. From L infinity to L2, it's bounded. Now, is there a p larger than 2, such that it is bounded from L infinity to LP? Well, I don't know how to tackle this problem, but I can say one thing. I can construct an example showing that if there is such a P, it is less than 4. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.